Hello and welcome to the Homegrown Food Summit. This is Marjorie Wildcraft. And with us today, we have John Moody, who is the Executive Director of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. I didn't realize what this is, but this is an organization that if you join it and pay some regular monthly dues, then you have access to all kinds of attorneys and help, and especially in case of a lawsuit. Now, I used to think, you know, homesteaders, lawsuits, what? But John really points out some issues that had certainly not been on my radar, such as the possibility of being accused of animal rights or animal abuse, or that in some places your right to farm is at issue. One thing that I've learned about John is that in his early 20s, he fell terribly ill with some bad condition that conventional medicine couldn't cure. And his family decided to pursue real food and traditional cooking techniques. And in under a year, he was able to regain his health. And with that, he discovered a passion to help others to do likewise and have the freedom to do otherwise. He's participated in small farm and food freedom movement in many ways over the years, also serving as an administrator for one of the largest local food buying clubs in the nation, the Whole Life Buying Club. Standing up with members of that buying club to unjust enforcement actions to deny people their access to real food, and dealing with some of the FDA's harassment of farmers and people seeking real food. He also speaks across the nation to people on matters related to food, health, and farming. And he has a forthcoming book on soil, and I like this topic, 6 inches of soil in 6 months and 600,000 bugs. That's going to be interesting. But let's watch John as he gives you the nuts and bolts of homestead laws.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Butcher, The Baker, and The Homestead Lawmaker. This is a talk that will cover common legal issues facing homesteaders and small-scale growers. So who am I? My name is John Moody. I am a small farmer in Kentucky. I have a wife and four great children who you'll get to see in a few of these pictures. We raise animals, vegetables, and trouble on our 30 the chickens. We've had ducks at times. So we're really familiar with what it's like to be a small-scale grower or producer, trying to navigate the array of issues and considerations and problems that legally we sometimes face trying to feed ourselves and the people around us. So, this is a little disclaimer. This article is intended for educational and informational purposes only, and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed, as either a legal opinion or as legal advice. The opinions expressed in this article are those of the author, in this case me, and not of anyone else. I do serve as the executive director of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. We're an organization that was founded to level the playing field and protect your ability to grow food and feed your community. So I'm here today in my executive director role, speaking from experience, having worked with the organization for many years and worked with many small producers and the different challenges they've faced in the modern food system. So we're going to review five areas today, in particular for small-scale growers to consider and be aware of. First one, we're going to talk about how to be a good neighbor, and especially how to stay out of trouble with your neighbors. Second, want to talk about animal abuse allegations. Third, we're going to talk about cottage food and cottage food law. Fourth, we're going to talk about on-farm slaughter and meat sale issues. And finally, we're going to wrap things up with a little discussion about right to farm and zoning. And again, this is kind of a general talk. One reason Farm to Consumer was founded is so that growers and producers such as yourselves, when you have specific questions, if you're a member of the organization, you get free legal advisement from one of our staff attorneys if you run into trouble or have questions that are a little bit above your pay grade. So how to be a neighbor, like a good neighbor. Being a good neighbor is one of the most fundamentally important issues of being a small-scale producer. Overwhelmingly, in our experience as an organization, the complaints that are filed against our members, farmers, and producers are generally instigated by an angry or upset neighbor, or on occasion an angry or upset competitor. the smallest fraction of complaints originate with the government all by itself. Most of them originate because of some relational neighbor issue or relational competitor issue for a producer. And so the first rule to being a good neighbor as a producer is you want to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You should remember the three S's. You should have an operation that smells, sounds, and respects space. So in terms of smell, does your operation create smells that would be irritating or annoying to neighbors surrounding you? Do you have poorly managed animals? You don't have sufficient bedding in your animal areas or some factor like that. Or if you're making compost, is the compost not sufficiently married to carbon to dampen down smells or other problems? Or is it, you know, attracting vermin and other problems? You want to make sure you're managing things so you're not creating smell issues. How about sounds? Often a neighbor will be upset by a rooster that's overly loud or a dog that is overly annoying. So do you have animals in terms of their behavior and in terms of their noise level that fits well with the environment that you find yourself producing in? And finally, space. Are you and your animals respecting the property lines of other people around you? So you may love having chickens on your property, and your neighbor may dislike having chickens. And if your chickens are crossing onto their property, then they have a reason to be upset. And so we want to make sure, just as a starting place with these things, in how we interact with our neighbors, we want to make sure we're showing them respect in terms of the smells coming off our property, the sounds coming off our property, and are we keeping what's happening on our property within our property lines? So another thing to realize with being a good neighbor is what you might be allowed to do legally may not be the best thing to do to keep good relationships with your neighbors. A perfect example of this in my home state of Kentucky is fence law. Kentucky law, the way it is currently structured, is if I were to build a fence along a property line, I could compel my neighbor to pay for half of the cost of the fence and half of the cost of the upkeep of the fence. And there is nothing my neighbor could do legally to stop me from forcing them to pay for that fence, even if they don't have animals, even if they derive no benefit from the fence, even worse, even if they're opposed to there being a fence along the property line, what have you. So while legally I could force one of my neighbors to share the cost of building a fence, you can imagine that relationally, that would be a very, very bad move. Another area this comes up is legally in some states you can shoot animals that are on your property attacking your animals. So say a neighbor has a dog that gets loose, and it's attacking your animals. Legally, you can shoot that animal, but depending on your neighbors and the relational status, it just might not be the best thing for you to do. That's not to say that you shouldn't take steps to protect your animals. It just might not be the best thing for you to be the one to shoot that animal in particular. So animal attacks are a common neighbor issue. They're common regardless of where you find yourself. We live out in the middle of nowhere, and yet we have had problems with dogs and other animals attacking our poultry and some other animals on the farm. And, you know, we have urban and suburban members who've had issues with animal attacks being within, you know, major metropolitan city limits. The first thing, especially with animal attacks, is you want to make sure that you understand the likelihood of your animals being attacked in the environment you find yourself and take reasonable steps to protect your animals. So if you have chickens in a urban, suburban backyard and you have lots of neighbors with lots of dogs, a chicken tractor that is properly built to withstand a loose dog just is good common sense. Or, erecting a perimeter fence around your property that would exclude dogs or similar animals who could cause trouble. So if an animal does attack one of your animals, again, usually the best course of action is to have good relationships with your neighbors and be able to talk with them. You may have no choice but to get local authorities involved, whether it be your sheriff, or whether it be in terms of especially urban areas, you usually have animal services divisions, that you can report problems to. But at the end of the day, if you can work things out directly with your neighbor without having to get authorities involved, it's generally going to be better for you and everyone else involved. One thing as well, if you are keeping animals, do realize that there is the possibility of penalties and fines if your animals escape, and especially if your animals escape and cause an accident of some sort. So this is one reason I'm a big proponent of proper fencing, because it's a two-way street. You're not only trying to exclude other people's animals, especially animals that are a threat to yours, from getting on your property, you're also seeking to include your animals, keeping them from getting somewhere where they could cause an issue that could become quite costly for you. So, moving on from being a good neighbor, we want to talk about animal abuse allegations. We are seeing a significant rise in such cases across the nation. And there's really a few different things driving this rise in animal abuse allegations. First, there is a push in some parts of the country to adopt laws, that protect animals from abuse. The problem with these laws is they often exempt large-scale CAFO producers, and they leave smaller-scale pastured producers basically with little to no protection from false accusations. Another thing that is driving this increase in animal abuse allegations against people who keep animals, especially on pasture or otherwise kind of in urban suburban settings, is PETA, Humane Society, and some other animal rights organizations have been partnering with the government to help them enforce or encourage enforcement of animal abuse statutes, laws, and regulations. The problem is, though, you are dealing with people who have little to no agricultural or livestock experience or knowledge, who, even worse, have a bias against people keeping livestock for meat, milk, eggs, for their economic and ecological value. And so these people are then using their sway with state local governments to then stir up trouble and strife for, pastured producers and animal owners. The most recent noteworthy case was the Joshua Rockwood case in New York, where Joshua was a farmer in New York, and most of you are familiar with last year. Large portions of our country through January, February, and March experienced incredibly cold temperatures. In Kentucky, we had 3 consecutive nights that reached minus 30 degrees. And so Joshua Rockwood, being even farther north in New York, you can imagine the temperatures that his farm reached, and you can imagine what that makes things like for caring for animals. And so Joshua found himself, because water was frozen when his farm was inspected, because animal feed wasn't laying around for certain animals. And this just shows kind of how ignorant of animal husbandry some of these officials can be. If you come to my farm, my farm is not a chicken bed and breakfast, and there is no buffet for my animals. Chickens get fed in the morning, chickens get watered in the morning, especially during cooler times of year. And then, they spend most of the rest of the day doing what chickens do, wandering about, foraging hither and thither, turning sawdust, turning bedding in the barn, doing what have you. The idea that animals should have 24/7 access to food and you know, heat and all of these other things is a disturbing condition for raising animals. So on the one hand, you do want to make sure that your animals are well cared for, that you are going, you know, above and beyond ensuring your animals have proper shelter, proper windbreaks, your animals can get out of adverse weather and to a place where they can maintain body condition. You do need to make sure that your animals have good quality food, but at the same time, we do not want to be forced to basically create animal bed and breakfasts in a way that actually would be detrimental to the animals and detrimental to our ability to for them to be economically productive and viable. It's also very important, in my opinion, for farmers and homesteaders to go on an educational offensive regarding what does sustainable animal husbandry and care look like. You know, now on occasion you'll see funny things about it on the internet. You know, if your animals are cold, if you're cold, then your animals are cold, and maybe you should consider bringing them inside. And that's what we're going to be doing in a couple weeks with a few of our cows. It's about time for them to get a permanent break from outdoor existence. But things like this I find more helpful for farmers and producers to use in educating. You know, animals, long before we domesticated them, lived well 365 days a year outdoors. And many of them actually prefer these kind of conditions to the man-made conditions we might try and get them to be accustomed to. And so you want to take time to educate people as to why providing animals a natural environment with appropriate food and water access and other things is in no way abusive. It's the very best thing for the animals. So you just really want to be proactive. You know, farmers and homesteaders and similar people, you also should probably take time to engage local officials, especially depending on what part of the country you find yourself. You know, so invite local officials out to your farm or homestead. Let them see how you care for the animals. The last It's always problematic when your first interaction with a local official is a negative one from a complaint. So take some time, be proactive in education, be proactive in protecting yourself from these kind of false allegations. So on to cottage food. So one of the bright spots, among many bright spots of the past 10 years for small producers, is the expanding ability to produce food for others right from your own farm or homestead or house. And this is often referred to as cottage food law. So cottage food laws, like many laws, especially developing areas of law, are in no way set in stone. So the cottage food laws, every single year, every single legislative session, you will see changes to many states across the nation in terms of what is allowed and not allowed, what are the caps, what are the rules and exclusions for cottage food. You can kind of cut up this area of law three ways currently. There's states that allow basic cottage food production. These are usually shelf-stable things like jams, jellies, breads, granolas, baked goods you can make in your home, and then you're able to make them available at farm stands, sometimes at farmers markets or roadside stands or other places. Some states have moderate cottage food laws. That would include the things above, plus they might throw in your ability to make certain fermented foods. Certain pressure canned items may also be permitted for home food production. And then there is a very narrow number of states like Wyoming, who recently adopted the Wyoming Food Freedom Act, who have a very robust cottage food law that basically allows a wide variety. The list of excluded things is smaller than the list of included things. There's very few things that you're not allowed to do in Wyoming, as opposed to basic states where there's very few things that you are allowed to home produce. Another way you can look at this is basically all states only allow the sale of non-potentially hazardous foods. And a potentially hazardous food in terms of legal ease generally means meat, dairy, and eggs. Those foods are considered potentially hazardous compared to grains, jams, jellies, baked goods, vegetables, fruits. And so those usually are not allowed under cottage food law exemptions. And cottage food is great. So, here in Kentucky, a certified kitchen will run you $20 to $30 an hour to rent. So not only will you have your cost of your inputs and gathering your inputs and driving to the kitchen, and setting up, you'll have to pay rent while you're setting up for the day. You'll have to pay rent while you're actually using the kitchen. And then you're also going to be paying this, $20 to $30 an hour fee while you're cleaning up the kitchen. When you can eliminate that massive overhead expense by producing right at home, or on farm or homestead, it really opens up an opportunity for great profitability and for creating value-added products from things you are already producing or growing. And so this has been a great area, a really great spot. We really hope to see more and more people push for greater freedom and opportunity through expanded cottage food. So now we want to talk a bit about custom and on-farm slaughter. So generally speaking, if you are butchering an animal for you and your family to consume yourselves, the only thing you will need to be concerned about is if your city or county or some other local jurisdiction has some sort of law or zoning ordinance or what have you against it. Now, obviously, if you're in the city, it's probably a bit unlikely that you're going to be butchering anything much bigger than a chicken in your backyard. But even then, it's probably good just to peek around and make sure that there's nothing, or sometimes as well, homeowners associations might have ordinances not only about what animals you can keep, but then what kind of behaviors you can engage in with those animals. But generally speaking, if there's nothing your city or your homeowners association or some other local jurisdiction says, you can butcher an animal on farm, on homestead, in your backyard, and consume that animal, no problem. The issue becomes as soon as you move into the sale of animal of something you have butchered. So other than poultry, on-farm slaughtered meats are not allowed to be sold unless you have an approved inspected facility on site. So poultry is the one exemption. So poultry is kind of an interesting place. The federal government has a 20,000 bird floor. That's the maximum number of birds that can be butchered on a farm or homestead and sold to the public, without having to go through an inspected facility. State governments, though, can choose to be more strict, but not less strict than the federal poultry rule. And so, depending on where you are, you'll need to check in with your state to see what the rules are about poultry that you raise and slaughter on farm, and then what avenues you are allowed to sell that. So some states you can butcher on farm, and you can sell at a farmer's market, whereas some states you can butcher on farm, but the only place you can sell is directly to the consumer off the farm or some other method or means. The only other set of animals that are kind of interesting are rabbit, deer, bison, quail. There's no federal inspection requirement for these four animals, but there are varying state requirements. And again, the state requirements often differentiate what they want from you based on who you are selling the meat to. So in some states, they will differentiate between sales that are to a restaurant versus sales to an individual. If you want to sell to a restaurant, they will most likely have you go through some kind of state or federally inspected facility, whereas for certain animals, you can get by just using a state facility or butchering on farm if you're selling to individuals. It's good to note some states still have what's known as a two-tier inspection system, while some only have USDA-inspected facilities. So back in the late 60s, when the Wholesome Meat Act was passed, and the artifice, this big kind of structure of meat inspection and regulation we now have, was instituted, most states had their own meat inspection systems. Over time, some states dropped their own inspection and basically handed over inspection only to the federal government. So in those states, your only option to sell meat within the state is USDA-inspected facilities. But there are some states, Indiana just north of us, I believe, is one example, where you have butchering facilities that are state-inspected, but they are not federally inspected. If you have an animal butchered at that kind of facility, you can sell those items within your state, but you cannot sell them outside of your state, the difference between intrastate commerce and interstate commerce. And so depending on what kind of inspection structure your state still enjoys, you may not have to go all the way to a USDA-inspected facility to still be able to offer meat for sale. You might be able to use a more local state-inspected facility. Now, there's a couple ways producers and farmers and homesteaders can work within the law to still sell animals and let people have some options in terms of where and how they're butchered or slaughtered without having to necessarily go through USDA inspection. So because the number of USDA inspected slaughtering facilities in the nation is very small. In the 1960s, we had almost 20,000 options for where to get animals butchered that then would have still allowed the animals to be sold. And now we're down to somewhere in the 2,000 range. And so it was such a, you know, in my state, most butchering facilities are multiple hours from farmers who need to use them, adding a great deal of cost to, you know, to selling an animal. Whereas custom slaughterhouses, so custom are generally slaughterhouses where it's not inspected, it's just a small private business that butchers animals for people's personal consumption, still dot the landscape of Kentucky. And so these small custom slaughterhouses are more widely available and accessible. And if somebody owns the animal, they can have that animal butchered at a custom slaughterhouse as opposed to a federally inspected slaughterhouse. So this is a very common way that people access beef and pork and also lamb. Farmers sell it by quarters and eighths. People own a portion of the live animal, and that allows them to have it butchered where they would like to, whether they butcher it on their own or they butcher it on the farm or they butcher it at a custom facility. It's one way that people can avoid having to use the more costly and sometimes harder to access USDA inspection with its additional costs and still be able to support small producers in an affordable fashion. So final thing that I want to mention in terms of, you know, the major challenges small producers face deals with right to farm and zoning. So right to farm is an area of law where a number of different states have adopted legal statutes that protect a landowner's right to engage in farming and food growing on their land. And this is, again, it's one of these areas, it varies greatly from state to state. And as these cases I've listed here that you can take a peek at show, even in states with very strong right to farm protections, such as Michigan or Virginia, the fact that your state has adopted right to farm legislation does not mean that that will stop a locality or a county from infringing on your right to farm protections and from dragging you into court. Randy Buescheler, farm to consumer member, his case is one of the major ones. He faced a pretty significant right to farm battle in Michigan. Michigan is just a hotbed for small farmers and producers and people who want to grow food. Probably it's the most active state in the nation for us in terms of threats and harassment of small producers. Another farm in Michigan, the Hudson case came not long after. It's interesting to note that a state often will have multiple requirements for you to meet and qualify under the right to farm protections. So while Randy Buescheler's farm won their court battle in Michigan, the Hudson case, Sweet Peas, they met the fiscal requirements under the Michigan Right to Farm Act to be considered a farm, but they did not meet what are called the GAMP requirements, which are the generally acceptable manufacturing requirements. So even if you're in a state with right to farm, you need to make sure you understand what all is required to qualify under the right to farm protections of your state. And again, even if you are complying and meet those qualifications to qualify for right to farm protections, that does not guarantee that an overzealous county official or an overzealous regulator will be able to not end up dragging you into court. So again, I hope this has just been a helpful overview for you on some common legal issues that you might face as a small producer. I really encourage you to consider becoming a member of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. There are many benefits to being a member. Many of the people I've mentioned in this talk, such as Randy Buescheler, as a member, you have the possibility that if you are taken to court, that you will not incur any costs associated with your legal representation. Our organization will pick up the bill. On top of the possibility of free representation, you also are entitled to, as a member, free consultation and advisement on the laws and regulations in your particular state. So, as this talk, I think, has made clear, state laws vary greatly, and not only do you have to navigate state laws, you have sometimes federal laws impinging on your operation, and you have local and county issues to face as well. And as a member, you can get free advisement from an attorney helping you navigate those things. And on top of all of that, we offer a wide array of continuing education opportunities for our members to help you continue to grow. And we also engage in a lot of grassroots activism so that things like cottage food, things like the Wyoming Food Freedom Act, which was brought about by farm to consumer member Frank Wallace and hardworking activists in his state, might become the norm across our nation. So we really look forward to having you as a member. We really look forward to hearing feedback from you on this presentation and some others we're giving as a part of this summit. And we hope your upcoming 2016 growing system is blessed and bountiful. Thanks.
Well, there you go. That was John Moody. And if you'd like to get in touch with them and signed up for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, looks like he's got Joel Salatin's back. That's pretty hearty endorsement right there. Click on the button over there to the right, and that'll get you connected up with John Moody and the Farm to Legal Defense Fund. If you were interested in that presentation, Judith McGeary with the Farm to Ranch Freedom Alliance has a very detailed presentation on exactly the laws you need to know if you want to become a small producer, especially a lot of the cottage food laws. Let's see, we also have Doug Simons. Something totally different. We'll show you how to make a pair of sandals. It's a little bit different from our normal, but it was so useful that we thought we'd put that one up. And another really good one coming up. David Goodman on Extreme Composting, the movie. Yes. This is Marjorie Wildcraft, and you're at the Homegrown Food Summit, and I will catch you on another presentation.